by sitting down with me, they were really, in a way, forced to be more reflective. So I not only reflected back to them some of what they were saying and not paying attention to, but I think sitting with me encouraged them to be a little bit more reflective themselves. They would have to slow down because they were trying to attune to me as I was trying to attune to them.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast was created in order to share with our colleagues and the community at large the many activities that psychoanalysts are involved in around the world that go beyond their individual clinical work in their consulting rooms. We have conversations with psychoanalysts who work with medically ill patients, who work in refugee centers, who work in community mental health centers, who work with police departments, with the United Nations, with business leaders, analysts who teach undergraduates, who work in prisons. There's a whole variety of quite remarkable work that analysts are bringing to various venues around the world. When COVID struck us all, we shifted our attention and we began meeting with analysts and talking with analysts again around the world to learn firsthand how they were dealing with this crisis and with the sudden shift to online treatment. And we've learned that different cultures, analytic cultures and political cultures, entail both similarities and differences among each other in how we're all facing this crisis. As part of that effort, we also began speaking with some of the elders in our field. And by elders, I mean those who've been practicing analysis for 40 to 50 years. And we asked them to reflect on this quite unique period of history and to also share their vision of our profession and how it's evolved for them over their many decades. In addition, psychoanalysis has always had a point of view about the societies in which we live. And we've been discussing with clinicians and psychoanalytic researchers on this new wave of othernesses that has been almost virus-like in wrapping the world, where groups of people from all vantage points are being treated as cold others. And there's something about our common humanity that is more and more difficult for us to hold on to. And analysts have a great deal to say about that, and we've been discussing that with colleagues, again, from around the world. And we're going to continue focusing on these three areas: work that analysts do off the couch, reflections on what COVID is doing to all of us, and hopefully what it will be like for us as we leave COVID hopefully behind, and also the reflections that we analysts have on the societies in which we live. I hope you enjoy these conversations. Please feel free to comment on our website, ipaoffthecouch.org. And thank you for listening.
Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast. I'm Dr. Stephen Rolfe. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Corporate and Organizational Consulting. I am managing principal of Rolfe Advisory, and I serve as an advisor and confidant to CEOs, board directors, family enterprise leaders, and leaders facing a personal life crisis. I'm delighted today to welcome Dr. Ken Isold to today's podcast. A practicing psychoanalyst and organizational consultant, Dr. Isold plays a leading role in exploring the extensive and multifaceted unconscious dimensions of our lives. His work uncovers how the knowledge and ideas we don't know we know, the beliefs and assumptions we don't know we have, decisively shape our thinking and behavior in organizations, politics, government, as well as our personal relationships. Dr. Eisold is past president of the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations. He is former director of the organizational program at the William Allison White Institute, which he helped to found. For several years, he directed the A.K. Rice Institute's National Conference on Leadership and Authority. A member of the Boswell Group, he has published in the Harvard Business Review and provided commentary for the Wall Street Journal. His most recent book, The Organizational Life of Psychoanalysis, brings together his work on the conflicts, dilemmas, and difficulties that have beset the institutes, societies, and associations of the profession throughout its history, and it illuminates the profound challenges it is currently facing. Good morning, Ken, and welcome to the podcast. The focus of our podcast, as you know, is the work that psychoanalysts do off the couch, how psychoanalysts meaningfully apply their knowledge, their craft, gained from the clinical setting to many different kinds of endeavors. And your career certainly serves to illustrate the broad range of applications of our psychoanalytic knowledge. So I thought we'd begin today by speaking about both how you think about the entire concept of so-called applied psychoanalysis and how you personally came to apply your expertise in so many ways off the couch.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here talking about these things, Steve. I think that our field really does need to appreciate the range of opportunities that exist outside of our consulting rooms, and I'm happy to talk about my own experience. I think that in my mind, I think of the way that psychoanalysis has sort of informed my work and has helped me is largely by making me much more sensitive to what people are saying and what they're not saying. I think of it as a kind of a clinical advantage, that I'm much more able to grasp, what's the full complexity of the communication process. So when I'm talking to someone, I'm not just looking to hear what they tell me, but I'm really mindful of what they're not telling me, or more precisely, actually, I think, what they're sort of hinting at and what they're really providing clues to how I can really get them to think a little bit more deeply, you know, about what the issues are.
Maybe you could tell us how you came to consulting from your analytic practice.
Sure. I mean, that's interesting. I think actually it's always interesting because there is no direct pathway. You know, I mean, to become an analyst, for example, you go to an institute and you get trained, and you know, through your supervisors, your teachers, or your analysts, you get referrals, and sort of off you are. You're sort of basically brought into an ongoing field. That pathway does not exist in consulting work, or rarely does it exist. So it really is more a matter of sort of serendipity. You may know that my first career was as an English professor. And I think because of that, I happen to know some people in the Modern Language Association. And so when I started consulting, you know, out of the blue, surprise, surprise, the first organization that asked me for some help was the MLA, you know, and I did for a number of years, I did workshops for them for, people who had newly assumed the role of department chair, English department chairs. And they were sort of like very much nonplussed by the whole way in which having that authority in the department changed their relationships with their colleagues. And so the workshop was really was designed to help them make sense of that and find ways, you know, around that. But mostly to kind of accept it and see it as built into the process. So So that was my first client. And then mostly, you know, once I did that for a while through friends, through contacts of people I knew, word of mouth is really basically what it boiled down to. That's really how I've gotten pretty much all my clients.
Yeah, you mention having been an English professor, and I know that one of your earlier papers on leadership, I think it was from 1997, on your website, I should mention, you give the example of your consultation with a university faculty, emphasizing the importance of the leader needing to see himself as connected to the group that he leads. And that led to your focus on the idea of the myth of the individual, or the heroic leader, I think you called it.
Right.
And I'm curious about how that idea and that interaction of the leader in the group, which you wrote quite a bit about, how you now think of it. Obviously, it has great relevance to this moment.
I think that's less and less an original idea. I think more and more leaders do very much understand the need to be linked with people who will follow them, because otherwise they'll sort of be out of touch. And I think more and more also, people, particularly in businesses, know that they have to assemble a team of people to work with, that they themselves don't have all the skills, you know, or all the knowledge or expertise that will allow them to be successful. So they really have to have other people available to them. And so in a way, they know they need help. And that's what I find that's really particularly gratifying about working with leaders in my consulting practice, because with patients, it's almost always a kind of ambivalence about wanting or needing the help that they're asking for. But with leaders, I find that's less and much, much less an issue. They're grateful. They know they need help. They're grateful for the help that they can get. They're much more open to receiving it. And they'll kind of be, once they feel like they're getting it from you, you know, they want more. So that's a very, very satisfying aspect of the work, the consulting work that I do.
I agree with that, actually. Maybe say more about some of the differences between therapy and consulting in your view.
And I think that's a very good question, Steve, because I actually think maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll change my mind or modify it when I hear what I have to say. But I think actually the main difference is the focus on the task. I think when you're working with someone in an organization, it's much more important to be really clear about what the problem is that the person wants your help with. In psychotherapy and particularly in psychoanalysis, in a certain sense, you have to allow the process to have its own unfolding. The process of free association and so forth tells you, or in a way ultimately leads you to, what are the more significant underlying issues that the person is grappling with or needs to grapple with. I think it is true that things unfold, things develop, surprising things happen, and you have to be extremely attentive to the associative process, because that's basically how the unconscious works. But you also have to be very focused on what the problem is that they're coming to you to deal with. So if I'm talking to someone, about the problem they're having at work, the difficulty that they have communicating with the people who report to them, how to make them more comfortable, how to make them more capable, which is a big issue actually for leaders, you know, because they may help their subordinates to be more effective. Something will come up, say, from time to time, you know, something, a chance remark about the person's marriage, you know, may emerge. Or they'll have trusted me to talk about certain things around work. And then they say, can I bring up something that has to do, you know, with my personal life? And I always say, yes, of course. But I also try to make it very clear, okay, now that's what we're talking about. I'm happy to talk about it as long as you want to. But in a way, I'm trying to remind them that we have a particular focus on a work problem, which is what they consulted me about in the first place. And when we're finished with the personal stuff, we're going to get back and talk about the issue that they're facing in their jobs. So I don't think I do anything different. In other words, I listen to the unconscious. I try to allow for the associative process to unfold. I ask a lot of questions. Maybe that is a little bit more different from some psychotherapists or some psychoanalysts. I tend to be more actively curious when I'm pursuing something. But by and large, I don't think I will ask about dreams. You know, will ask about is something on their mind. If I detect something in their voice that sounds a little suggesting that something is troubling them, I'll ask about it. I'll ask them to reflect how did they feel about the conversation that we had say, the day before. And all the kind of stuff that you normally do when you're working clinically with patients, there's nothing I do that I wouldn't do working in a consulting relationship. But the main difference is an effort on my part to maintain the focus on the purpose of the relationship, why they consulted me in the beginning.
In one of your writings, you make mention, you talk about what the analyst brings to the consulting space, and you talk about the role of anxiety, being able to pick up on the anxiety in the person that you're speaking with, as well as defenses against anxiety, mm-hmm. and also the role of transference. I think those are the three things that you mention,
right?
As what we bring. Would you still hold to that?
Absolutely. I mean, it seems to me that's the bedrock, it seems to me, of psychoanalytic practice. And I think that's where I feel that I was very much helped through my own psychoanalytic training. You know, the coursework was useful. You know, the lectures were interesting. But I think it was mostly working with people in practice day after day and getting supervision, having questions raised about what was actually going on in the person that I was working with, that may develop my sensitivity to the emotional side of the relationship, and particularly the anxiety. You know, whether someone's not allowing themselves to feel the anxiety that they need to feel in order to face something that's troubling or difficult in what's going on in their lives, or if it's that they are anxious and they make that sometimes maybe too anxious in a way that makes it hard for them to think kind of clearly. But to be sensitive to that, it seems to me, if you're working with people, is the main thing.
One of the things that you mentioned supervision, and I just want to mention, you know, in the early days of our doing this work and making the transition from clinical practice to doing consulting, that it was seen by many as heresy. But that always struck me as kind of funny, because we always did supervision, which I always thought as an application mm-hmm. of clinical practice. And it seems to me that there's a lot of similarities between supervision and consulting.
I think that's that's true in a certain sense. You could say with a client in business or even in government, you take on a supervisory role. The word that's frequently used is coaching. I don't particularly like the idea of coaching because I don't think, I mean, coaching implies, you know, sports and competition. And I don't think I'm particularly there to help my clients win at any particular contest. I am trying to help them always in a sense to be more effective, you know, to be more successful. But that doesn't, that doesn't always involve necessarily a kind of a competition. But it does mean that I'm helping the person. I'm consciously helping the person. And so I might offer occasionally, you know, a tip or a suggestion, you know, that one way that some people or others have found useful in dealing with certain situations, you know, is the following. You know, I may say that. I certainly don't feel as if I ever want to hold back something I feel I understand, although it may well be that the timing isn't right. And some sense I may hold back temporarily because I'm waiting for a better opportunity to get into it. But I think it is very much like, as you were saying, Steve, I think very much like supervision, because these are people who are bringing to you their work, you know, what they're doing, you know, in their offices or with their clients. And they sort of want help with it. So in a certain sense, you're supervising, but often, as often happens with supervision too, you're looking a little more deeply, you know, into the motivation, you know, into the experience, and trying to get a better purchase on what's going on.
So we've talked some about what an analyst brings, what skills from your training, clinical practice are most helpful in doing consulting work. I know you were past director of the organizational program at White, and I'm wondering what you think analysts in particular need to learn. What does psychoanalytic training not prepare you for as far as working within organizations?
That's an excellent question. You know, in my own career, I think as much as I have been helped and influenced by my psychoanalytic training, I have also been helped and influenced by my training working with organizational groups, mostly in the so-called Tavistock approach that was developed in London 50, 60 years ago. And in this, in America, it's sort of promoted by the A.K. Rice Institute. For many years, I worked on the staff of conferences. I directed conferences. And the purpose of these conferences is to give people much more direct experience and awareness of what goes on in groups and to sensitize them to the experience, to the fact that their behavior is very much influenced by the group context in which it occurs. So much so often that the only way to really understand behavior at times is what it is doing for the group, how the group is really influencing the person to behave at a particular moment. I work, for example, let me give you a brief example of this. I worked for the law firm for a long time, a small law firm. And I met with all the partners of this. There were 8 or 9 partners on a regular basis. And the two senior partners would frequently fight with each other in the meetings. They basically take over the meetings. And so the junior partners basically took a back seat and let the two senior partners go after each other. And it took a while to kind of get everyone to sort of realize that in taking a back seat, the junior partners were actually egging the senior partners on. they were like creating the conditions that really made it inevitable that they would fight with each other. And in that way, they were not just being neutral, they were actually avoiding avoiding their responsibility and their contribution to the dynamics of the firm. And it's only by kind of repeatedly hammering away at the fact that the two senior partners, acting as senior partners often do, were really doing it on behalf of the group, and that really was allowing the group to take a kind of a passive, invisible role in the dynamics of the firm.
Certainly an interesting example. I want to turn to another example, if we could. I know you did a lot of work with traders. I don't know if you're still working with them, but I wonder if we could use that as an example of, to get into some more detail about the kind of work that you have done in organizations.
Sure. Right. Again, this happened quite sort of serendipitously. I think someone I had worked with, maybe on a group relations conference or in some sort of setting like that, was married to a commodities trader, an oil trader. And she suggested to her husband, who was having difficulty with his trading, that he might benefit from talking to me. So he came and we met and talked. And I was helpful to him. And he suggested my name to others that he was working with. And in fact, at one point, I was seeing something like 5 or 6 oil traders who work on the commodities exchange in downtown New York. In fact, one of them told me that among themselves, informally, they referred to me as the shrink to the Merc. But I enjoyed working with them a lot. And what I discovered is that they are very driven people, but also most of them suffering from some attention disorder. So one of the things that suited them to be traders on the Merc was the rapid way in which their minds worked. Something, the kind of thing that really made it very difficult for them often to do well in school, because school learning is often very slow, very laborious, and takes time and involves a fair amount of reflection. Trading is a very speeded up, very quick, very hasty kind of process. And so in a sense, your mind has to be out there following things as they're moving in a very, very, very rapid way. And so at the time when I was working with these oil traders, it did not take place online. The training was all in person in trading pits, circular areas that were set up physically in our sense to facilitate communication among a sort of small group of maybe 10 or 12, 15 or so people who would be shouting orders, requests, orders, purchases, sales, back and forth in a very, very, very loud, noisy, and very, very rapid way. And one of the things I learned is that the ones who were really good at it were able to pick up a lot of secondary information in that process by the body language of the people in the pits trading with them, by the tone of voice, by the pauses, by the communications that went on between them. They were gathering an enormous amount of information about the market and where the market was going to go. They were not only suffering from it, sort of in a certain sense an attention deficit disorder, but that given that when the object that they were trying to focus on was moving so quickly and so rapidly, there was a kind of a fit between the speed of their mind that made it hard for them to focus on other things. but also the thing then they were now trying to focus on, because it was moving. They could keep up with it because, you know, their minds were actually very kind of speedily racing. But in addition, they were also picking up a lot of additional information, not only just about the prices of the oils and what else was going on in the oil market, if there was like a refinery fire or kind of a glut, you know, elsewhere that had materialized. So they really had a kind of almost, they were very, very physical beings, you know, very intense, very quick, impulsive. They often led very disordered lives. You know, they would go to frequently after work. They'd drink a lot. They'd use drugs a fair amount. You know, they drove all-terrain vehicles. You know, they did extreme sports, some of them. They went to titty bars. You know, they used a lot of prostitutes. They were living always in the fast lane. And that's what suited them. They were built that way. And so that's, in a sense, the kinds of lives they had to basically live, because that's how their minds work. That's how their bodies were functioning.
So they don't sound like our typical clients in the sense of being prone to introspection. I'm curious about what brought them to you. What kind of help were they looking for? What did they need?
Right. And so it's precisely because they completely lacked introspection, because they were always rushing on to the next thing, you know, and their minds were restless and fast-paced, that by sitting down with me, they were really, in a way, forced to be more reflective. So I not only reflected back to them some of what they were saying and not paying attention to, but I think sitting with me encouraged them to be a little bit more reflective themselves. They would have to slow down because they were trying to attune to me as I was trying to attune to them. And then things would sort of start to occur to them, and they would start to see frequently, you know, that they were the bad trades that they were making, for example, you know, one day, was really stemming from some anxiety. They had created a kind of a deadline for themselves or a kind of a goal. You know, they were thinking, yeah, I got to make $100,000 today. You know, got to trade that to make that kind of money. And frequently, that put pressure on themselves, quite apart from the pressure that stemmed from the market itself. And so when I could sort of see that, and I could sort of reflect back to them, you know, are you really pushing yourself to kind of make a certain goal? And they would say, yeah. And I said, well, maybe it would work better if you didn't. You know, maybe you'd reach your goal more successfully if you didn't feel so pressured to do that, to get there. And in fact, that frequently worked with them. But that's just like one example of the kinds of ways in which I could sort of feed into them insights that would very rarely come to them because they were so busy. You know, their minds were always so active.
But it's a great example, right? It's a great example of the unconscious need to affect decision-making.
Right.
It reminds me of, talk about a merger, right? What's the reason that someone's going through a merger? Does it really have to do with the merger itself? Or does it have to do with some unconscious need to make the company bigger for its own sake, and it's not really justified, that the financials don't really justify it?
Right. I mean, a lot of people sort of who are really very active in financial markets, and of course, if you're in New York, that you'll see a lot of those people, you know, people really who are working for hedge funds or for banks, in one way or another, you know, they're tuned into the kinds of trading that's going on among businesses and corporations. But again, it's a group, very much a group process, so that if some company is thinking about acquiring another one or merging with another one. There are, on both sides, there are teams that are thinking about it and that are very much influenced by the thinking, you know, in the team, you know, the assumptions that the team accepts, maybe unquestioningly. And sometimes it's very difficult to buck those ideas. You know, you always, of course, in a certain sense, have to fit in with the people that you're working with. And I think that's particularly true now, going back to what you were raising earlier in the discussion, Steve, because I think now people do work much more on top levels in teams. So we speak of the C-suite, you know, the top officers, the chief, and not only the chief executive officer, or the chief operating officer, the chief financial officer, the chief technology officer. Anyway, all the people who are the chiefs, basically, they are talking with each other all the time. I mean, that's to say, if they're functioning effectively. And so if you're working with someone like that, and I know you frequently have to bear in mind that it's not just changing their mind, but getting them to talk about how they're fitting in with their teams. Who are the other people who are shaping the behavior and the thinking of the team? And if you don't somehow get to think about it that way, you're often making it difficult to be successful because you're leaving out of account very much often what's determining your client's behavior.
Yeah, I wonder if you've had any follow-up with some of those traders. Obviously, the trading has changed so much.
I'm glad you asked me that, actually, because it's only quite recently that one of the traders, I've had stopped seeing traders because once, you know, they closed up the Mercantile Exchange and they all went online, all the trading was automatic. And so the role that computers played in making trades became much, much more significant. And if my traders were very fast acting and very rushing themselves constantly, it's nothing like what computers can do, right? So in a certain sense, they were more and more at a disadvantage in the way they were trading. So the way their approach to trading had to change really dramatically. And so they stopped seeing me because the way I was able to be helpful to them have basically become somewhat obsolete. But more recently, someone came back to me after several years of not seeing me. What had happened is that he was working with a group of other guys. He called it, "I'm working with a room." Now, this is a room, this is a virtual room, because some of the people in this room are in New Jersey, some of them are in New York. He himself is in Florida. So when I talk with him on Zoom, he's in Florida, but he's telling me about all these people in the room that he's working with. And so part of the way I'm trying to help him now is to understand his role in that group, in that room. What I was able to kind of point out to him is, in a sense, that he's become a kind of leader. And I know he didn't really grasp that they were following him in the way that they were, because he never thought of himself that way. He thought they were imitating him, or they were borrowing from him, or on certain cases sort of stealing from him. Or on the other hand, at times they were unwilling to learn from him. So I was helping him to understand his role in the group that really was turned out to be useful. And so it's less to do with the trading and more about the interpersonal relationship.
Right. So that's very clear and helpful. I think you've explained the kind of work you do with your characteristic clarity, and I really appreciate that, Ken. I thought we'd close the interview by going back to this whole question about the relationship between leaders and followers, and I wanted to quote a paper of yours from 2004 after following one of our financial crises, because I think it has particular relevance to now. So I'm going to just quote the end of this paper and ask you to comment. "Now disillusioned with our heroic CEOs, we blame them for their narcissism and greed. Those targets of self-deception are in our sights. But that could be an act of self-deception on our parts if we focus only on their flaws, their excessive ambition, their inflated, shallow characters. I would argue that we got and we get the CEOs we deserve. We didn't want to know that these goals of ever-increasing stock values could not be met. We allowed ourselves to be blinded, focused on our constantly increasing mutual funds, our investment portfolios, our pension plans, our endowments. We did not think of the cost. And the CEOs, the CFOs, the COOs, et cetera, were blinded to the risks they were running, setting up the management structures designed to squeeze their subordinates to perform, dismantling corporate loyalty, replacing it with the insider groups loyal only to them, designed to enhance their performance and the bottom line. I don't mean at all to suggest that our current villains are not guilty or do not deserve punishment, but that doesn't take us very far. Where the pressures and temptations remain the same, new candidates for fame and infamy will always appear." Hmm. Do you remember writing that?
I do. You know, it does seem a little dated. I mean, I suppose I was very much responding, you know, to things, you know, things that were like happening at Exxon, you know, and
Enron, Exxon, I think. Yeah, in those days.
Enron was the word I was, the name I was searching for. Thank
yeah.
you. And, you know, and so there was a, around the turn of the century, there was a big, there was a whole slate, you know, of villains. I mean, I think it's sort of still true in a sense, but I think that the role of the CEO really does have has more significantly changed. I don't think we as a society are as much looking for heroes in our corporate leaders anymore. I think they've become much more. The questions are, there's still a lot of emphasis on the need to raise the stock prices of corporations as a measure of success. And I think there's still a lot of pressure on that. But I think more and more that there's an awareness that we need people to run organizations that, in a sense, are safe, that really respect. They contribute to employment, that do not damage the environment, and that, in a sense, are citizens in their own, good citizens in their own communities. Now, I think there's much more of an emphasis now on those factors as well. And so it's a... there's still the competitiveness of the market, and particularly our dependency on financial returns from stock markets and so forth, is somewhat worrisome, and it somewhat distorts the ability of CEOs and other leaders to take on socially relevant, socially responsible positions. I don't think it's quite as bad as it was when I wrote those words. But I certainly meant those words when I wrote them.
Well, I think reading that paper, those words pertain to a lot of the dynamics between leaders and followers, and may have more particular relevance to our politics at the moment.
Yes, that is, that is true. Yes.
Well, Ken, I really want to thank you so much for participating in this podcast. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me. I very much appreciate talking about my work. Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.